Genesis chapter 31. Jacob heard that Laban's sons were saying, "Jacob has taken everything our father owned and has gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father." And Jacob noticed that Laban's attitude towards him was not what it had been. But then the Lord said to Jacob, "Go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah to come out to the fields where his flocks were. He said to them, "I see that your father's attitude toward me is not what it was before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I've worked for your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. If he said, 'The speckled ones will be your wages,' then all the flocks gave birth to speckled young. And if he said, 'The streaked ones will be your wages,' then all the flocks bore streaked young. So God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them to me. In the breeding season, I once had a dream in which I looked up and saw that the male goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, or spotted. And the angel of God said to me in the dream, 'Jacob,' I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, or spotted. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land.' Then Rachel and Leah replied, 'Do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? Does he not regard us as foreigners? Not only has he sold us, but he has used up what was paid for us. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God has told you.' Then Jacob put his children and his wives on camels, and he drove all his livestock ahead of him, along with all the goods he had accumulated in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan." Someone has said, experience is not what happens to you, it's what you do with what happens to you. There's some wisdom in that. There are a great many people who have a lot of so-called experience, and yet they don't profit from it at all, because they're just bad learners. Take, for example, the case of Mrs. Betty Tudor, a lady resident in Exeter. At the last count, Mrs. Tudor had clocked up an amazing 273 hours of driving lessons. In that time, she has exhausted 9 instructors, and has been banned from 3 driving schools. She has only taken the driving test 7 times, but has failed them all. On the last occasion, she went the wrong way round a roundabout, and the examiner was so terrified he insisted on driving the vehicle back to the test centre himself. Now, clearly, Mrs. Tudor has something of a mental block where driving is concerned. Alas, there are plenty of Christians who have similar difficulty in regard to the whole of life. They go to the grave, maybe in ripe old age, but with their L plates still firmly fixed to their backs, as far as their personal spiritual growth in wisdom and character is concerned. The writer to the Hebrews in the New Testament complains about this state of arrested development in some of the Christians of his day. By this time, he tells them, you ought to be teachers yourselves, but you still need instruction. You need someone to go over the first principles of Christian living with you again and again and again, like an infant that can't be weaned off its milk diet onto solid food. I think it's very easy to sympathize with the exasperation of the writer in that. All of us who are in pastoral ministry know the disappointment of laboring in Bible teaching, pastoral counselling for years and years, only to find the spiritual equivalent of a Betty Tudor in our congregation still driving the wrong way round roundabouts. Perhaps, though, we should not chide such slow learners too severely. For, of course, if we're honest, we all take far longer to grow into Christian maturity than we need to or we ought to, don't we? Over the years, there has been a persistent tendency among some evangelical Christians to underestimate this. Many have wanted to argue that the sanctification of a human personality can be accomplished at a stroke. Early Wesleyans talked about sinless perfection. The early Keswick speakers used to talk about full surrender. And of course, those in the charismatic and Pentecostal traditions have often talked about being filled with the Spirit. But in every case, the basic idea is very similar. Namely, that it's possible to achieve the goal of Christian holiness in a single step, through a one-off crisis experience in your life. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood on this point. Undoubtedly, there is a measure of truth in that claim. The Christian life does sometimes advance in quantum leaps. There are critical moments in the history of most of us, as far as our spiritual lives are concerned. Moments like the moment of conversion itself, which for many is dramatic and sudden and quite life-transforming. But the danger is, of course, that precisely because the emotional intensity of moments like that is so great, we invest too much significance in them, to the neglect of the equally important but less dramatic process of gradual change that is going on, or at least should be going on, all the rest of the time. Indeed, to return to the analogy of poor Mrs. Tudor, there are many spiritual learner drivers who, under the influence of this kind of crisis-centered teaching, never really discover how to make normal progress along the Christian highway. Instead of a smooth transition through the gears, their spiritual life is a succession of kangaroo jumps. A spasm of enthusiasm, followed by uncontrolled inertia, and finally a stalled engine. They lurch from one decision to the next, one reconsecration to the next, one filling of the Spirit to the next. Their whole Christian life is a series of fits and starts. And the result, of course, is that many years after their first commitment to Christ, these undisciplined hops have actually taken them very little further along the line for Christian maturity. They still have their L plates on. Now, it's precisely in this area that it seems to me the story of Jacob has something to teach us this morning. If you were here last week, remember we said that God has two strategies for changing human beings. We used a geological analogy, remember. We said he uses both the seismic upheaval of an earthquake and the gradual erosion of a river. Sure, there are moments of volcanic crisis that, as it were, turn the spiritual topography of our lives completely upside down. But equally vital to the reshaping of our personalities is that longer process of attrition as a river cutting its way through a valley, whereby our lives are educated. Now, Jacob's life illustrates both of these. Last week, we studied the earthquake. The day when Jacob, alone and insecure in the wilderness of Canaan, met God personally for the very first time. So momentous was that moment that he set up an obelisk, you remember, to mark it, and named the place Bethel, the house of God. But this week, we come to study the aftermath of that very dramatic crisis in his life. See how chapter 29 begins. Then Jacob continued on his journey. Literally, he picked up his feet. It would be 20 years before another spiritual crisis would punctuate his life. 20 years before he would even return to Bethel, the place of his first spiritual crisis. 20 years of humdrum, unspectacular, ordinary daily life. But in those 20 years, Jacob would learn lessons. Lessons that could only be learnt in the gymnasium of ordinary experience. Lessons which the spiritual high spots of Bethel could not teach him, but which could only be gained in that mundane, uneventful tedium which he came to associate with a place called Padan Aram. Now, what we're going to do this morning is conduct a whistle-stop tour of those 2 decades of Jacob's experience. I want you to observe with me the subtle way in which God's providence gently but very firmly molds this man. So he becomes more and more a man of faith. There are 4 lessons in particular that we see God teaching Jacob through his providence in this long, difficult, and in many respects uneventful period of his life. He learns, first of all, that there is a better motive in life than greed, for instance. He learns, for instance, that it hurts to be cheated. He learns that there are some things human beings can't achieve or organize for themselves. And most of all, he learns that God can be trusted. That God can be trusted to fulfill his promises, even if he takes 20 years over it. All those lessons Jacob will learn in Padan Aram, he could not have learned them at Bethel. And if we learn nothing else this morning, we need to learn also that it is not only by dramatic spiritual earthquakes, but by the steady attrition of ordinary human experience that God wants to shape the landscape of our lives. Let's look at those 4 lessons then together. First of all, that there is a better motive in life than greed. Look at chapter 29, verses 16 and following. Now Laban had 2 daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, "I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "It is better to give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me." So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel. But they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love. The American politician Hubert Humphrey once said that behind every successful man, there is a surprised mother-in-law. I don't know whether that was true in the case of Rachel's mother. We don't know much about her. But what we can say with certainty is that falling in love did have a most improving effect on the hero of our tale. Up to this point in the story, as you know well if you've been following the last 2 studies, Jacob has displayed a consistently selfish, grasping attitude. Greed and ambition have controlled and driven this fella. But now, quite suddenly, he has discovered a whole new perspective on life, a totally different reason for getting up every morning. Jacob served 7 years, but they seemed like only a few days to him, because of his love for her. According to my concise encyclopedia of psychology, love is a, quote, cognitive affective state characterized by intrusive and obsessive sexual fantasizing. Which no doubt is true up to a point. We're all familiar with the stereotypical love-struck young Romeo who moons around all day with his head permanently in the clouds. But it's important to realize love isn't always so dreamy or so impractical. Love can have immensely positive effects in a person's character and outlook, and it does so in Jacob here. Indeed, haven't you seen it? I certainly have. Over the few years I've been watching people come into this place and eventually get married. One has seen untidy boys on falling in love suddenly go out and get a haircut. One has seen idle boys on falling in love suddenly go out and apply for a job.
One has seen drunken boys suddenly discover the determination to give up alcohol, and prodigal boys the motive to go along to the bank and open a savings account. And in the case of Jacob, you see, we see a habitual cheat and a liar who suddenly discovers the enriching joy of an honest day's work. I wish we had time to look in more detail at the account of his first meeting with Rachel. It's told for us in the first half of chapter 29 here. And there's an unmistakable note of humour running all the way through it. See, he arrives at the well after his long journey from Canaan. The readers of Genesis know that just to arrive at a well in this particular part of the world is to plant the scent of romance in the nostrils. For it was at just such a well, of course, that Abraham's servant, when he had come seeking a wife for father Isaac, had met Isaac's mother-to-be, Rebekah. Rebekah must often have told Jacob the story of that encounter, and he must surely have been wondering whether he would have the same luck. Could it be that the God who had met him at Bethel would provide him with a wife in this alien land so many miles away from home, just as he had provided Rebekah for his father Isaac? And would he meet her by a well? Does lightning strike twice in the same place? He asks himself. Well, scarce has he introduced himself to some of the local farmhands at this well than our narrator confirms our half-formed expectations in the matter. Verses 5 and 6 of chapter 29. Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson? He asks the shepherds. Yes, we know him. Is he okay? Yes, he is. Oh, look, at here comes his daughter, Rachel, with the sheep. Surprise, surprise. Of course, she's still somewhere away at this point, but even at a distance, Jacob can see what a stunning girl she is. Rather clumsily, I feel, for Jacob, he suggests that the shepherds might feel like going for a walk for a few hours. Look, he says, the sun is still high. It's not time for the flocks to be gathered, is it? Water your sheep quickly and take them back to pasture. But these yokels are not so thick as Jacob takes them for. They have seen his eyes light up as they fell upon the lovely form of Rachel. Who wouldn't like the opportunity for a cozy tete-a-tete with her all alone by the sheep? Well, no dice, Jacob. With their tongues no doubt firmly in their cheek and a good deal of elbow nudging going on, they give him a feeble excuse about how heavy the stone is over the well. We always wait here till all the shepherds have arrived. It's easier to move that way, old chap. Jacob is not convinced. For neither is he going to allow their obstructiveness to deter him from chatting up this beautiful girl. So flexing his muscles in what he hopes is a suitably impressive fashion, he marches over to the well and moves this notoriously heavy stone single-handed. Rachel, no doubt suitably impressed, oohing and aahing, is further taken aback when he boldly introduces himself to her and, again perhaps a little uncharacteristically, allows his pent-up emotions to flood out. Verse 11. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. Now, you mustn't get the wrong idea about this. Jacob is not being outrageously forward. I have no doubt this was a perfectly proper and modest cousinly kiss. His own uncle greets him in a similar way in verse 13. It was done in that culture. But I don't think we're speculating wildly, are we, if we suppose that Jacob's hormone levels definitely rose a little at the closeness of Rachel's cheek to his own. For within a month, we're told, he's head over heels in love with her. Indeed, within a month, he's so besotted he's ready to give her the engagement ring, which in those days could be quite expensive. Beautiful girl like Rachel could only be bought at the equivalent of 7 years' income. Such was the bride price which parents demanded as compensation for the loss not just of a precious daughter, but of an economic asset. Those of us who perhaps find the idea of paying for a bride somewhat mercenary need to reflect that if we had to pay for our brides, we might divorce them less frequently. Many a boy's parents, of course, would cough up this large sum. But it seems that Jacob had been sent out into the wide world by his father Isaac without a penny in his pockets. A signal, no doubt, of paternal displeasure, which Laban was not slow to read or exploit. 7 years for Rachel? It's a deal, he says. But they seemed like only a few days to Jacob, because of his love for her. That surely must be one of the most lovely sentences in the whole of the book of Genesis. and remembers Burns' rather similar lines, "The man that loves his mistress well, no travail makes him weary." For the first time in his life, you see, Jacob is not plotting or conniving, he's not wheeling or dealing. He's working for his living, working honestly, patiently, happily, contentedly, because he's no longer motivated by greed, but by love. And there's many a young man who has been grateful to a woman for teaching him the same lesson. But mark this, you never learn such a lesson at Bethel. You only learn it at Paddan Aram. As indeed goes for the second lesson Jacob learned, that it hurts to be cheated. Look at verse 20. "They seemed like only a few days because of his love for her. Then Jacob said to Laban," we're talking about 7 years on now, "give me my wife. My time is completed and I want to lie with her." One has some sympathy for this young man. So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave her a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob. And Jacob lay with her. And Laban gave his servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as her maidservant. And when morning came, there was Leah. Now once again, Jacob's pain is offset by the humor, which some of you have detected, if not all of you, by what is quite clearly intended to be a situational comedy, I think. I can't help recalling the rather similar tale of a fellow called Darsan Yilmaz, who lived at Dalmally on the Black Sea. It's reported in the newspapers that in August 1972, this amorous young fellow, whose advances had been spurned by a neighbor's daughter, decided he was going to abduct the young lady in question by night. He was quite convinced that such a romantic gesture would not fail to win her love. So just after midnight, he climbed the ladder to his beloved's house, threw a blanket over her sleeping form, and carried her off down to his car, whispering torrid endearments into her ear, or at least into that end of the blanket where one might reasonably assume her ear to be. Away they sped into the night, his heart delirious with joy and sweet anticipation. Once out of the city, he stopped the car and unwrapped his precious cargo and pursed his lips for a kiss. And that was when he discovered the person he had abducted was not his girlfriend at all, but her 91-year-old grandmother. According to the newspaper report, she took the welcome opportunity to beat him about the head. Well, Jewish readers of this ancient story here would surely have been able to stifle their belly laughs too at an all too similar scenario. Jacob turns in bed on the first morning of his honeymoon, anxious to see the alluring beauty of his new bride in the clear light of dawn, no longer hidden behind the lace of her wedding veil or cloaked in the darkness of night. "How was it for you, my darling?" he begins to say. But he's halted in mid-cliché. For as she lifts her sleepy head from the pillow, it isn't lovely Rachel who lies there, but cross-eyed Leah, her ophthalmically handicapped ugly sister. Speechless with rage, he bursts from the tent. Laban has stolen his rose and left him with the thorn. "What is it you've done?" he says. "I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me?" There is Laban, cool as a cucumber, butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. He smiles indulgently at the young man, shrugs his shoulders, raises his eyebrows in feigned surprise. "Oh, I'm sorry to see you're so upset, Jacob," he says. "I thought after 7 years among us, you knew our customs by now. We never marry the younger sister first. I naturally assumed that you'd realize if you wanted Rachel, you'd have to take Leah, too, as part of the deal. Tell you what, just to show you there's no bad feeling, I'll let you have Rachel as well. Just give Leah a week, and then you can have Rachel. I'll trust you for the additional 7 years of labor, which you will, of course, have to work for me to earn her bride price." We've been saying all the way through that Jacob was a cheat. Well, now we know where he gets it from, doesn't he? It was his mother's side of the family, most definitely. But that, of course, is actually what makes the irony of this situation so exquisitely poignant. I wonder if you've picked it up, you see. Here is the guy who has cruelly deceived his father. And now he has been cruelly deceived by his father-in-law. Here is the guy who pulled the wool over Isaac's eyes, quite literally by means of a cheap disguise. And now he's been duped by a similar impersonation. Here is the guy who stole the rights of an elder brother. And now he himself has been defrauded in the name of the rights of an elder sister. See how clever God is? Talk about poetic justice. Talk about a taste of your own medicine. It's a classic case of the biter bit, isn't it? And Jacob surely cannot have failed to note the parallels. The parallels between what Laban and Leah had conspired to do to him and Rachel, and what he and his mother Rebekah had conspired to do to Isaac and Esau. He has been stitched up, good and proper, and by, of all people, his doting mother's brother. Does he feel angry? Does he feel injured? Does he feel indignant? Does he feel humiliated? You bet he does. Did he feel like punching Laban on the nose? Did he feel like Esau? Like murder? Yes, I suspect Jacob felt all those things. Because it hurts to be cheated. And you, Jacob, who have cheated others so ruthlessly, need to understand that more than most. Perhaps you'll think twice before you cheat someone again. Now you know what it feels like. It's a lesson you needed to learn, Jacob, but you would never have learnt it at Bethel. Such lessons are only learnt at Padan Aram. As again is the third lesson he learnt. That there are some blessings you can't organize for yourself. Look at verse 28 of this chapter 29. Jacob accepts the inevitable. He finishes out the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gives his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maidservant. And Jacob lay with Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he worked for Laban another 7 years. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Of course, if there's one thing Jacob should not have needed to be taught, it is the folly of favoritism within a family. Hadn't he and his brother Esau not proven how destructive such rivalry can be? But I suppose in this situation he just couldn't help himself. His unequal devotion generates between his two wives exactly the same kind of a breach that Isaac had generated between his twin sons. But since this time, there is no Rebecca to balance the unequal family triangle, God himself steps in to console Leah for her frigid marriage. And he steps in a way which only he could. Leah became pregnant, verse 32, and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, "It is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now." What a thing for her to say. Surely my husband will love me now. If only it were that simple, dear Leah. Many an insecure spouse has entertained the same false hope. Children will make it different. Children will keep us together. I'm afraid children may cement a good marriage, but they rarely do anything to improve the quality of a bad one. Fact is, of course, no man on earth can truly be in love with two women simultaneously. The adulterer always kids himself he can, but it's an emotional impossibility. Eros is a possessive passion. It can't be shared between two. That's why any polygamous society you care to look at on earth always contains a great many unhappy and undervalued women. That's why secret love affairs rarely remain secret for long. The cheated partner always detects the cuckoo in the nest sooner or later. And that's why, dear Leah, no matter how many sons you bear Jacob, you are never going to win from him more than his conjugal duty. She conceives again, verse 33, and again, verse 34, and again, verse 35. But all that happens with every new baby that Leah bears is that Rachel's sense of failure and inadequacy grows more intense and her rivalry towards her sister more bitter. Eventually, of course, it starts to undermine her relationship with Jacob too. Verse 1 of the next chapter, when Rachel saw she wasn't bearing Jacob any children, she became jealous of her sister. She said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." And for once in his life, Jacob is completely no scheme, no strategy. "Am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children?" he asks. He has to face the fact that even he, the master manipulator of circumstance, cannot engineer a solution to this problem. Oh, he and Rachel try, of course. They try every means at their disposal to circumvent their disappointment. For a start, they turn to the ancient equivalent of a surrogate mother. Verse 3, she said, "Here is Bilhah, my maidservant. Sleep with her so that she can bear children for me and that through her I too can build a family." It was a conventional practice in those days in the case of an infertile wife. And it works in the sense that Rachel now has a couple of kids she can, after a fashion, call her own. But the rivalry in the family is only further intensified because you see in verse 9, when Leah sees that she stopped having children, she takes her manservant Zilpah and gives her to Jacob as wife. It's a classic situation, you see, the children caught in the middle of a marital unhappiness and finding themselves little more than pawns in their parents' private war. Rachel is there, still longing for children of her own. This time, she turns to the ancient equivalent of a fertility clinic. Verse 14, during the wheat harvest, Reuben went out into the fields and found some mandrake plants, which he brought to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." The point of these mandrakes, of course, is in the ancient world they were believed to have potency as an aphrodisiac, that they increased the chances of fertility and potency and so on. But alas, once again, Rachel's attempt to benefit from these mandrakes backfires. For the price of getting Reuben's mandrakes is that Leah has Jacob for the night, and she has yet another baby as a result. Alas, poor Rachel. And then, quite suddenly, quite unexpectedly, without any connivance on either Jacob or Rachel's part, God just graciously stepped into their lives. And after possibly a whole decade of barrenness, he did what he could perfectly easily have done years before. Verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son and said, "God has taken away my distress." You can just imagine the joy that filled the heart of Rachel and Jacob at that news. Some of you here, I know, have had problems having children. And you know that firsthand. Here is something, you see, we simply can't organize for ourselves. All of Jacob's instinct when confronted by a problem is to try and find some scheming solution to it. But here is a problem in his life that can't be solved like that. Here is an ill that only God can remedy. Here is a gift only God can bestow. And Jacob needed to learn that the most important things in life are always like that. But he would not learn that at Bethel. You only learn that sort of lesson in Paddan Aram, on the back of many years' experience. And that goes to, for the last, the fourth lesson I want to draw your attention to here. Namely, that God can be trusted to fulfill his promises. Chapter 30, verse 25. After Rachel gave birth to Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, "Send me on my way, so I can go back to my own homeland. Give me my wives and children for whom I have served you, and I will be on my way. You know how much work I've done for you." But Laban said to him, "If I have found favor in your eyes, please stay. I've learned by divination the Lord has blessed me because of you." He added, "Name your wages, and I will pay them." By this time, I guess, Jacob had been in Laban's employ for well over the 14 years he had contracted for his two wives. He was a middle-aged man now. We have seen he has a substantial family of his own, and at last, beloved Rachel has a child. It is time to think about their future. There's no way he's going to be dependent on Laban indefinitely. It was time to start accruing some wealth of his own, rather than feathering the nest of his father-in-law all the time. He's shrewd enough to know that Laban can't afford to get rid of him. He's too valuable as estate manager. Laban hardly needs a crystal ball to realize that the reason he's grown so rich in recent years was down to Jacob's business skills. But Laban, being the crafty Shylock he was not going to make it easy for Jacob to acquire capital of his own either. What Jacob needed to find was some arrangement with his father-in-law that was proof against double dealing, because he knew if Laban could diddle him, he would. And with typical imagination, and as we shall see, not a little divine inspiration, Jacob had an idea on that score. Verse 29. "You know how I've worked for you and how your livestock has fared under my care. The little you had before I came has increased greatly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. But now, when I do something for my own household?" "What shall I give you?" Laban asks. "Don't give me anything," Jacob replies, taking the wind out of his sails. "But if you will do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. But let me go through all your flocks today and remove from them every speckled or spotted sheep, every dark-coloured lamb, and every spotted or speckled goat. They will be my wages. And my honesty will testify for me in the future. Whenever you check on the wages you have paid me, any goat in my possession that is not speckled or spotted, or any lamb that is not dark-coloured, will be considered stolen." And like lightning, Laban said, "Agreed! Let it be as you have said." What he didn't tell Jacob, of course, was that he had already formulated a scheme for making sure there were no speckled or spotted sheep in the flock. That same day, he sends his sons out into the field to collect every marked animal of that kind and take them 50 miles away from the herds, which Jacob was responsible for. You see the kind of fellow this Laban was. He knew enough about genetics to realize that spots and marks on sheep's wool are an inherited characteristic. Ergo, take all the spotted sheep away, just leave him with the white ones. He won't get much wages that way, will he? Unfortunately, of course, Laban didn't know as much about genetics as he thought. Long before Mendel did his famous experiments, Jacob had observed that sometimes A white ewe served by a white ram produced a spotted or streaked lamb. Because he didn't know anything about recessive genes or any of those things they talk about these days. In common with the popular science of his day, he assumed this phenomenon must be down to some experience the parent animals it had during mating. And that's what explains the rather strange ritual he goes through in verse 37. Jacob took fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. Then he placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. And when the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches. And lo and behold, they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. He did his best, then, to influence his flock according to the standard theories. We, with the benefit of greater scientific knowledge, know he needn't have bothered. His real genius, of course, lay in the selective breeding which he engaged in once these marked animals had been born. He fixed the gene for spots and streaks among the strongest animals in the flock. That was the really crafty thing. Of course, Laban immediately saw what was happening. Within a single season, he could see that his plan had misfired. "Oh, Jacob," he said, next time lambing was coming round again, "I decided to change our contract this year. This year, you can have all the spotted sheep, and I'll have all the streaked ones." But blow me. Next season, there were very few streaked ones, and almost all the strong sheep were spotted. So the next season, it was the other way around. I did it wrong last year, Jacob, but this year you can have the streaked ones and I'll have the spotted ones. But again, it all worked out to Jacob's advantage. And the upshot of it all was, within a few years, Jacob was a very wealthy man. And Laban was feeling very, very peeved. Verse 42. The weak animals went to Laban and the strong ones to Jacob. In this way the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large herds and maidservants and menservants and camels and donkeys. The thing I particularly want you to notice, though, about this reversal of fortune for Jacob at this point in his life is the way he personally interpreted his newfound prosperity. Because that's very important. That's why we read that section from chapter 31 a little earlier. The old Jacob would undoubtedly have taken the credit for all of this himself. He'd have congratulated himself on how clever he had been, outdoing his crafty father-in-law, beating him at his own game, thinks he knows about animal husbandry. But the fact is that that is not how Jacob saw it. Look how he speaks to his wives, Rachel and Leah, in chapter 31. "Your father's attitude toward me is not what it was before," he says, "but the God of my father has been with me. You know I've worked for your father with all my strength, and yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. If he said the speckled ones will be your wages, and all the flocks gave birth to speckled young, and if he said the streaked ones will be your wages and all the flocks bore streaked young, so God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them to me." Now, I simply don't believe that that's Jacob trying to put a veneer of spirituality on his own grasping, greedy cleverness. Some commentators interpret it like that. I simply don't believe it so. I think we are seeing here a man who, after 20 years, has at last realized his fortune is in the hands of the God of Bethel. And I'm supported in that by the testimony to this dream, which Jacob goes on to tell us about. "In the breeding season, I once had a dream in which I looked up and saw the male goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, or spotted. And the angel of God said to me, 'Jacob,' and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, or spotted, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me.'" No doubt Jacob's husbandry skills had played their part in the growth of his wealth. But it's quite clear, I think, from this dream that Jacob had also been seeing the hand of God at work, providentially in his life. He doesn't tell us when he had this dream. I don't think it's impossible that the very idea of asking Laban for the streaked and speckled and spotted sheep actually derived from this dream. It was from God he got that idea in the first place. There's no way, you see, you can come out on top playing Laban at his own game. Jacob realized that. The only thing you can do is to lay your vindication before God and pray that his overruling providence will see to it that at the end of the day, you are blessed. And that's what Jacob has been doing. It had taken him 20 years to learn it, but learn it he had. God could be trusted. If cheats prosper in this world, it is a very ephemeral prosperity they enjoy. You may see the wicked prosper for a short while, says David, but look at them a few years downstream, and they're nothing. Solid joys and lasting treasure are the heritage of those who put their faith in the promises of God. Jacob, remembering that earthquake of an experience he'd had back in Bethel, and relating it to the whole of the 20 years that had happened since, had learned to put his trust in that God. A God who keeps his promises, even if it takes him 20 years to do so. But I say again, you don't learn to put your trust in God like that. At Bethel, that kind of faith is the fruit of experience. You only learn it in Paddan Aram. I know many of you here, indeed, I can speak for myself too, we've all had our private Bethels, haven't we? Those of us who are Christians, at least, we've had moments in our lives when God has been very especially real to us. Moments, perhaps, when we have made vows, when we have felt in some very fundamental sense changed at the root of our being, that the whole direction of our lives has taken a new turn. For many of us, conversion or baptism is such a moment, such a Bethel. I say again, the temptation is, when you feel spiritually dry or confused later on in life, to look around for another Bethel. The temptation is to try to regenerate, to rediscover the feelings and the intensity and the drama and the novelty and the assurance of that crisis moment you recall from the past. Sometimes I think it's the influence of Hollywood that's responsible for this sort of association in our minds. It was Sam Goldwyn, I think, who said, "What people want in a movie is a story that starts with an earthquake and then works up to a climax." I think some of us want our spiritual life to be something similar. We take our cue from soap opera scripts, you know. There has to be a new crisis every episode, every day, every week. God has to be doing a miracle. Nothing short of a supernatural miracle every week will suffice to keep us feeling he is alive and at work in our experience. It's little wonder we feel disillusioned. Little wonder we complain about the spark going out of our spiritual lives. We are expecting Bethels to be part of normal everyday experience, when in fact, they are a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Learn from Jacob this morning, then, not to be dismayed or discouraged by those comparatively unexciting periods of your Christian life. What we need to remember is that real godliness of character is not something God zaps us with in a single moment. Real godliness of character is the fruit of experience that it takes years to learn. maybe like Jacob. Some of us need to learn that love is a more satisfying reason for living than greed. There's many a young person you know that thinks they have a spiritual problem and actually they have a lack of emotional growth. They tell the pastor they are feeling listless spiritually. In fact, what they really need to do and want to do is fall in love. And until they have, until they've crossed the divide into married life, they are going to feel odd. Maybe there are some of us like Jacob who need to have a taste of our own medicine. We've been unscrupulous. We have cheated people. We've sinned. Maybe God needs to rebuke us for our moral rebelliousness. Irony, you know, is not just a literary device. Irony is a feature of God's real-life providential dealings with people. If we're wise, we will keep alert to it. Or maybe, like Jacob, we need to learn there are some things we can't organize for ourselves. Maybe some of us need to be brought to a point of personal despair, of personal incompetence. Maybe, like Jacob, we have a big head. We think, I can manage any situation. I'm clever, I'm shrewd, I'm crafty. No situation in life will get the better of me. Maybe we need to face a barren womb and realize there is no answer to that except one that God will give. Or maybe, like Jacob, we simply need to learn that God can be trusted. That he will set a table before us in the presence of our enemies. That our cup will run over. That he is our shepherd. And at the end of the day, he will bless us. Even if right now we have to pass through a valley of the shadow of death. I'll tell you something interesting. When God sent Jesus into the world, it's quite conceivable he could have sent him on a cloud. He could have floated down from heaven as a man of 33, just down to Jerusalem. But he didn't. Jesus was conceived in a woman's womb. He passed through the trauma of a birth canal. He passed through the hazards of childhood and the temptations of youth. Not until he was 33 was he ready for the great work God had sent him from heaven to accomplish. Why? What was the meaning of all those years? It is again the writer of the Hebrews who tells us. Though he was a son, he learned obedience. Even the sanctification of the Son of God took time. He had lessons to learn, lessons that could not be learned in heaven, but could only be learned in the nitty-gritty daily routine of human experience. 33 years of it. It will be the same for you and me. It will be the same for you and me. Don't let impatience rob you of the lessons 20 years of Paddan Aram alone can teach. Let's pray together.